Yo, welcome back to the Educated Guest Podcast. I'm your host, Caesar Does It. Find me on them Twitters at ZARF, C-Z-A-R-E-F-F. I got a special guest in the house tonight. He's an old friend of mine. We met way back in the days. He's now a published professor at Southwestern College, and he goes by the name of Michael Wickert. I know him as Channel. We got to drop that disclaimer, though, before we go any further. We had a bunch of crappy opinions, and this is our outlet. And in no way, shape, or form do those crappy opinions reflect upon our employer or any of the associations that we work for. All right, having said all that, let's just jump into the episode. Welcome to episode 11 of the Educated Guest Podcast. I'm your host, ZARF, a.k.a. Caesar Does It on the Twitters. And I got a good friend of mine and a special guest today. I'd like you to introduce yourself.
I'm Michael Cheno Wicker, Profe Cheno. I just joined Twitter, man. It's, you know, there's a lot of cool stuff going on out there.
I saw that.
Some Profe Chenos.
Did you throw a picture on there, or are you still an egg?
Nah, man, I'm still an egg, man. I gotta do something, but, you know, I don't know, kind of like incognito. I don't know.
I've known Channel for a long time, since we were late teens, and well before we had our degrees and well before we were teaching in front of students. I first want to ask you, like, where are you from? Where'd you go to school?
I'm from all kinds of places. I'm one of those people who went to 18 different schools before I graduated high school. So statistically, I should probably be in Donovan or Calipatria or someplace like that. I ended up graduating from Mount Miguel High School, and we had moved from Spring Valley up between Worthington and Meadowbrook off of Paradise Valley, mm-hmm. and I was supposed to go to Morris. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for those listeners who remember Southeast back in the late 80s, man, Morris was no joke. And I knew that I was not going to graduate if I went to Morris.
I spent 2 years at San Diego High and then ended up graduating from Morris in 91. It wasn't that bad, but the neighborhood surrounding it was active, to say the least.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, but late 80s, I think it was 88. There's all kinds of gang activity that happened, and there was a couple bodies that were left
in an alley. I remember that.
And yeah, man, there was like this whole thing kicked off between the Filipinos and the Bloods and the homeboys and that mess. And my brother was going to Bell at the time, and it was chaos, man. Mm-hmm. 87, 88, 89, it was chaos, man.
I was at Bell at that same time, too. That's a trip. I wouldn't meet your brother until maybe the mid-90s, early 90s, but I was at Bell at that exact time. Keep going back to where you went to school and all that. So were there any teachers in that madness of going to all those schools? Were there any teachers that made an impression on you, good or bad?
I guess the bad part, what I would have to say is I never knew most of my teachers, mm-hmm. right? For all those years, I just never knew any of them, and they just didn't know me. The exception being when I got to high school, I had this teacher, Elizabeth Ruiz. She got married. I think her last name was Exum. I remember she even invited us to her wedding. Mm. So she grew up in Montgomery Street behind Montgomery Elementary by the alley. And so when she went over to Mount Miguel, she was first started out as a Spanish teacher and then became an art teacher. And so she would just like kind of grab all these homeboys and grab everybody and be like, no, come on. You got to take these art classes. They started up a Mecha club, so we all got into Mecha. Mm. So I was actually in Mecha with Guadalupe Corona, who's now over at the college.
That's a big name.
Yeah. And she's been there for a little bit, and we were just in a meeting a couple months ago, and she's like, man, I remember you from Mount Miguel. And I was like, yeah. And so it was kind of cool, man. Like we're seeing people kind of come full circle. And I don't know if you know Rudy Guevara, who's over at Arizona State. Mm-mm. He also went to Mount Miguel, and now he does all kinds of stuff with Asian Pacific Islanders, and he's written a couple books on being Mexipino. Mm-hmm. And I guess on both sides of his family, mom and dad, he's Mexipino. And so he's got like this whole history of all this kind of cool stuff in his family. And now he's doing big stuff, like kind of worldwide, man. He's just like cool stuff. Mm-hmm. So those were two people I went to school with who really kind of made it out and were doing stuff. And I think part of that had to do with Ms. Ruiz. She really just, like, she stuck with people. When I got in trouble when I was 16 and they were looking for any reason to get me kicked out of school, she was like, no, you come here, you come to the art room, I'm going to set you up a little table in the back, and you're going to stay there, and you're going to go to your class, and you're going to come back here, and I'm going to take care of you, like, basically every fucking day mm-hmm. until the courts say that you're free and you don't get kicked out of here. And so, you know what I mean? So to have a person like that really just kind of stick by you at that age, which, you know, 15, 16, 17 years old, man, is chaos in your body. Hormones are going everywhere. We had Andrew Dice Clay going off. We had the Morton Downey Jr. show.
Dang.
People started throwing chairs at each other long before any of these other people were doing it. You know what I mean? So we had all that kind of stuff going on at that time. And at the same time, we had the crack epidemic. We had San Diego was really known as like this major supplier and manufacturer of methamphetamine. So the drugs were just crazy. Stuff was just going off like in a really, really crazy way. And we had that teacher. And then there was another teacher, Evelyn Burroughs, who I only had for half a year when I was a senior. And she got a job at the San Diego County Office of Education.
Okay.
And I don't know what happened to her, and I wish I could find her just to say thanks, man, because she just kind of took me under her wing to some extent
uh-huh.
and validated that what I was going through was okay, where a lot of other teachers were like, you know what, you're not doing your homework, but you're smart, so that means you're lazy.
Right, right.
As opposed to, you know what, you're not doing your work, but why?
Mm-hmm.
And so you sit there and you go, well, I'm not doing my work because at the time, my mom had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
My mom's got breast cancer. I'm trying to take care of her. I'm doing this and that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, damn. You know what? That sucks.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I don't want to give you a free pass, but can give you some consideration.
Gotcha.
You know, like those little things that we sometimes forget or they're not taught to us when we go to like our credential programs and stuff. Like these are human beings with real lives. They're not just numbers. They're not student IDs. They're not just, you know, percentiles. They're not quartiles on a paper. They're flesh and blood. They got a soul. They got a voice. They got a family. They laugh and they cry and they kick and scream and they'll roll down on the floor laughing with you. You know what I mean? Like there's a difference, and I think the kids really understand when you care about them genuinely, like to the point where you will sit there and listen to them for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Me working over at Southwestern College, I come across young adults who are trying to figure a lot of stuff out. I come out with older adults. I come across veterans with PTSD. I had a former Navy SEAL in one of my classes one time tell me he was trying to figure some stuff out. And I said, well, what are you trying to figure out? And he says, you know what? I've been trained to do something, one thing. And I'm good at it, and I don't want to do it anymore.
Ooh.
And I don't know how to proceed.
Mm.
You know, and you look at a guy who's in his early 30s, and you look him in the eye when he says that, man, and he means it. And you got to interpret, like, how do I then help this person through his journey? You know, and that's a tough thing, man. That's a tough thing. But that happens at all levels of education, whether it's me at the community college or it's you in high school or it's when I was teaching in elementary school. Somehow you got to find a way to get there. And the teachers who really helped me were those teachers who tried to find a way.
All right. We're going to jump all over your timeline here real quick because I want to give my listeners an idea. Tell me all the places you've taught. Tell me all the levels. Start from the beginning. Where's the first place you taught?
Whoa. Okay, so, all right. So, So I got a backup. I was working in NASCO, left there, got hurt working in commercial construction, actually working up in Qualcomm, mm-hmm. back when they were building Qualcomm, not the stadium, the actual company, okay. Qualcomm.
Okay.
So I got hurt. I was on disability. I had worked on a mural project down at Montgomery Elementary with a special program over the summer. So when I had gotten hurt, I went down to talk to that principal and I said, hey, man, could you, you know, think you could help me out, get a job in the district? And I was thinking maintenance.
Yeah.
Right. Because I was carrying tool belts and wearing boots and using four letter words and drinking a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So I go down. He was like, yeah, man, it's cool. I remember you, man. I'll give you a reference. So I actually got hired as a maintenance worker for the Chula Vista district. That would be 96, I think. Mm-hmm. 95, yeah, 96. Couldn't pass the physical.
Oh, damn.
Got hired, actually. Was in HR signing paperwork, and they said, all right, the last thing you got to do is go over here, get your physical cleared real quick. It's going to take you about an hour. We'll expect you back here at like 3 o'clock, whatever, you know, whatever the timeline was. Mm. All right, cool. Go to get do the physical, come back and sit in HR. I forget who it was who I was talking to, and he said, you know, this sucks, but I can't give you the job. You didn't pass the physical. Like you would be a danger to workers, or you could get hurt, and then you go on disability, and that becomes counterproductive.
Right.
And I was like, man, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's a big blow right there. Boom.
And so he goes, you know what? We were looking at your application, and you put in transcripts. So you went to Southwestern College for a while, and you did pretty well. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah. And he says, well, why don't you go be a TA? And I said, TA? I'll be a TA. I don't make any money, man. I got to survive. Mm-hmm. So he goes, well, you know what? I'm looking at your transcripts, and you're pretty smart. You could go to college and become a TA here, and you will live so far below the poverty level, the government is going to give you money to live on and to pay for your school and all that stuff. And I said, well, I don't know, man. Let me think about it. And he said, no, there's no thinking about it. Once you walk out of this office, that's a no, unless you want to try it. You can try it, and if you don't like it, then you quit. But give it a shot.
That dude right there helped you out, didn't he?
That dude helped me out big. And I can't even remember who it was, because at the time, you know, I was just like, dude, I wanted to be a maintenance worker, man.
Somebody in HR at a Chula Vista Elementary School District straight put it down for you.
Put it down and said, you could potentially have a future here. Have you ever thought about being a teacher? And I was like, well, yeah, man, but, you know, I carry tools, man. I like cut stuff.
That was far removed. Stuff. That was way out there for you.
Yeah. And so he was like, just try it. And I said, you know what? All right, man, I'll give it a shot. Why not? And I was kind of excited walking out of there. Like, yeah, this would be kind of cool. So the first place they sent me was to Castle Park Elementary, TAing in a kindergarten class on a Friday before spring break. Mm. And it was like chaos.
Yeah, yeah. I can imagine.
And I was like, you know what? This is actually kind of cool, man. Okay. This is actually kind of cool. So I stuck with it. I ended up going to work at Greg Rogers for a while. I worked down at Finney for a summer school. I worked at Valley Vista for a little bit. This is all just as a TA.
Okay.
Then I went to Rosebank. Then I got sent over to Feaster. And I was at Feaster for like 2.5 years or a year and a half before I finally finished my degree. But just to back up, when I was at Rosebank, my wife had started student teaching there, and we met when she was student teaching, and we ended up working in the same class because I was kind of shadowing this kid who had some behavior problems, so I was helping him out.
Okay.
And she was student teaching in that same class, so we got to know each other really well over the semester, and her birthday and my birthday are 5 days apart at the end of May. So as the school year was winding down, the person I worked for, Chuck Bowerman, you know, I was dating this other girl, and he was like, why don't you ask her out, man? And I was like, well, I'm seeing this other girl. And he's like, the other girl's got 3 kids, man. Why don't you ask her out, man? She's going to be a teacher. You want to be a teacher? You should marry somebody who's going to be a teacher. I was like, marry? He's like, okay, I'm not going to get ahead of myself, but you should at least ask her out.
Yeah, man.
And so I did, and then the rest is history, man. So that's been over 20 years. So
More good advice from some dude, right? Some dude's like, why don't you ask her out?
Yeah, why
some dude's like, why don't you go to school and become a teacher? You're just full of people offering you advice.
You know, and it's just crazy, man. It's just crazy. And so, you know, so then I do that. I'm a Feaster. I finally get my degree. I was worked at Feaster from 97 to 2007. And now I'm over at Southwestern College. Over the summers when I was still a TA, I also worked in Juvenile Hall. Mm-hmm. And that was quite an experience. And any one of your 21 listeners out there.
Yeah, you got it, man, 21.
Any one of your 21 listeners out there interested in going into teaching young ladies, man, one thing I learned working in Juvenile Hall is I for a while they had me working in the girls' residential housing unit. And, man, these young ladies, these girls, would tell me stories basically of what got them locked up. And there was nothing good about those stories. And I would reflect on them and think to myself, you know what? I think at the time I was like 25, 26, 27. And I was thinking to myself, like, man, these like 14, 15, 16 year old girls are like bearing their soul to me as much as they can to a man about what got them in that situation. And I can just imagine what they would tell a woman that they would maybe have more of a connection to. I can just imagine that they're like just these young ladies who are locked up in there do not want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And some stuff along the way really impacted them to a point where they just started doing things they shouldn't do, and that got them locked up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that I was considering staying working in Juvenile Hall, but then when I was talking to my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, and she was just telling me, like, look, if you really want to prevent this, go become a teacher and help the kids before they go to Juvenile Hall. And so then that's what I did. So at Feaster, I mean, Feaster is a high transient, you know, low socioeconomic, all kinds of issues that were going on over there. So I worked at Feaster for 10 years, and then now I'm over at Southwestern College. I've been there since part-time 2005 to 2007, and then I've been there full-time since 2007.
All right, and let's put some context on that, because my listeners don't know you. I do, but they don't. What do you teach over there?
I teach English and education.
Mm-hmm.
So for future teachers, so I got a bunch of stuff going on, man. I started out as an English and education teacher, and I really like teaching English. I like teaching composition. It's cool. Gives voice to kids. And education, this is kind of the pathway, early classes going into the teaching profession. In addition to that, I also run a program called NeuroLinks, which is a program which we set up at Southwestern. We, meaning me and some colleagues from Disabled Student Services and others, to help support our students on the autism spectrum.
Okay.
And so we're in our third year right now with that program. And from what I understand, we were the only community college and maybe the only institute of higher education in San Diego County that has support services like this for students on the autism spectrum. I do that because my son is on the autism spectrum. And originally I started thinking, I want help for him when he eventually makes it to college.
Okay.
And so I realized, you know, that, you know, working in school long enough, you know, it takes a while to get things going and
absolutely
stuff, right?
Yeah.
And then it has to become institutionalized so that, you know, there's funding and all these kinds of things. So it was very much a very long-term plan with a little bit of a selfish intent, but it's there now and it's helping a lot of students. So I helped do that, the NeuroLinks. I'm working with San Diego State to help students from the South Bay pass their writing proficiency exam at higher rates and figure out how we can work more closely between Sweetwater, Southwestern, and San Diego State, and try to align some curriculum without trying to be like SDSU's baby brother, doing what they're telling us to do.
Yeah.
And not just also being an extension of the high schools, because you guys got stuff you got to teach, and we got stuff we got to teach, and they got stuff they got to teach. And now how can we make this all kind of fit together the right way? So that's another program I'm working on. And then my other one that I'm super, super excited about right now is the Intense Teacher Education Preparation Program, which is going to be working with people from the dual language education department over at SDSU, and we are working to create a 4-year pathway to completing a BA and a BCLAD within 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so students would begin their first 2 years at Southwestern College, finish their second 2 years at SDSU, and when they're done, they will have a BCLAD.
So is this program in the, it's in the works?
We're in the planning. We have been working on it for 6, maybe 8 weeks.
Okay.
So we're in the early part of an 18-month planning grant. And so anybody out there listening, man, dual language people, hit me up, man. Let's get together and talk.
All right, as we jump into this first break, I want to tell you about a video that you can find online that I'm really, really proud of. KPBS did a series on seniors, active seniors, and my father-in-law, Luis Monge, he was the finale to that series. It's called Intergenerational Action. Again, you can find it on kpbs.org. When I met him, I knew him to be a great man. He worked many years as a housing inspector, but when he retired, he became even more active. He's part of the California Senior Legislature, and he happens to be my youngest child's best friend. So again, shout out to Luis Monge, Intergenerational Action on kpbs.org. Let's get back into this. You and I both grew up street kids.
Oh yeah,
and you were big in the graffiti world.
Yeah.
And now we're all grown up adults, and I still love graffiti. You know, I'll admit that I'm a big hypocrite because if I see some beautiful writing on the wall, doesn't bother me, but if a kid goes in my room and tags on my wall, it's a problem. So I'm a big old I'm a big old hypocrite like that. But I love art. I love street art. That was your thing for many years.
Yeah, that was and it was interesting because it was at sort of like this cusp from the early mid '80s into the '90s, and there was this really interesting transition where there was kind of this confusion between gangs and graffiti, and my brother Dies, some of you may know my brother, Dies One. He is really the big graffiti artist. I mean, he's well known. He just got back from Thailand. He spent 2 weeks in Thailand over there painting and tattooing. But during those times, there was just a lot of confusion because it was still pretty regular if you were going to have any kind of street credibility to be involved with the gangs. But then graffiti came along and kind of changed that. And so there was this overlap where gangs and graffiti kind of mixed for a while, and you know, especially the late early 90s, and things got pretty rough for a bit, and that was really unfortunate. But for the people who stayed with it and stayed with the graffiti and stayed with the art, it really has done some cool stuff, man. I have another friend, Izzy, who teaches over at Wolf Canyon. He was a graffiti writer too, and He actually got busted. I hope you don't mind, Iz. I got to talk about it. He got busted in a sweep done by STPD back in the early 90s, and you know, that's, you know, some stuff kind of happened, but that also helped push him to go to SDSU, I think, and you know, kind of refocus, and then he became a teacher. So he does art. He teaches second grade, and but he also does a lot of stuff with art, and I believe he got a grant or something to go paint a new mural at Bell. So he asked me if I wanted to go help him over at Bell, man. Maybe we'll take you over there too, man.
That is sick. That is awesome. That's awesome. So he hasn't done it yet.
No, he hasn't done it. He's like, he'll let me know when he's going to start.
All right, you got to text me on that one because I'll be there, dude.
For sure.
I miss Bell Junior High, dude. I miss that stuff. Yeah, you know. There was a lot of that overlap, and you kind of avoided that, no?
To some extent? To some extent, yes. To some extent, no. But at the end, I mean, I came out of it, and, you know, it's kind of weird. You know, like if you're living around a lot of chaos, right? So if I go back to the late 80s, living up between Worthington and Meadowbrook, that was just chaotic, man. You know, it was chaotic. So even if you didn't want to try to be a tough guy, you still had to be able to hold your own. So you know, to this day I still carry a knife, and but I see it as a tool, right? Because I still use it every day as a tool, But if I reflect back to why I probably started carrying a knife in the first place as a kid, it was not to be used as a tool. I just fortunately never had to use it as a weapon. So that was good. And, you know, I could pop out my tooth, man. My tooth got knocked out.
My man just pulled out a tooth real quick that was attached to a piece of plastic that goes on the roof of his mouth. So that's one of the notches.
That's one of the notches, yeah, man.
Whoa.
And so, you know, it's, you know, there's some things here and there. So, you know, you don't get through it without any, you know, without any bumps.
Mm-hmm.
But I think being able to go through that and having people around you who appreciate the fact that you want to go to school and do things, that's a big thing. I think that was a big thing for me. That was really big because, you know, I got to have homeboys who've been in and out of prison. And they're still like, hey, that's cool. You want to be a teacher, man. You know, like you're a civilian and nobody's going to mess with you. And if they do, then, you know, hopefully the situation doesn't get too bad. But, you know, they try to not involve you or me in certain situations because, you know, it's like, hey, you can't go teach the next generation if, you know, you're sitting in a cell in Donovan or something. You know what I mean?
True that. I'm going to take you somewhere else real quick. Let's go through the hip hop stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You are one of the few guests where I can actually talk some real hip hop with. In San Diego, who are some of your favorite people in hip hop?
Oh, dude, man. You know what? I just got to go back, dude, to Cutfather, man. I know he's not living here anymore,
yeah.
But dude, that dude was the man. When he lived in Paradise Hills and we live right there off of Woodman, man, we cruise up there to his pad, and him and his brother Primetime, dude, they were just comedy.
Yeah.
And they were good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And
yeah.
LPSD, oh man, that was the business, dude. That was the stuff.
Shout out Cutfather and LPSD, King D, Black Grand, Ice Lee, and them. You
dude,
know what I mean?
That was the business, man. Shuffle your feet on down the street with those guys, man. Behind the post office, man. The Green Circle Bar.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, I remember the Green Circle Bar, man. Like that was when it first popped up, and there was an ASR 432F show. I think Cutfather was supposed to, I think it was Cut and maybe even LPSD was supposed to do a show with like Ole Madrid or something like
probably
that.
Probably Ole Madrid.
And then they just like, they cut them off and they were like, nah, we need a new place. And so we cruised around and somebody came across the Green Circle Bar and Johnny from the Green Circle Bar, he didn't know it all. And he was like, yeah, man, you want to set up some turntables, bring some people in my bar, man, cool. It was all like really impromptu, man. And like Zodak was there and Brisk and everybody, like all these people, those heads from back in those days. Orko.
I was there that night.
You were there that night?
I was there that night. And that was my first time in the Green Circle Bar. And that sounds exactly like Ole Madrid to cut him off at the last minute.
Yeah, dude.
Because Ole Madrid ultimately was not that venue.
No.
They weren't gonna have some street kids that they ain't never heard before come up in there and perform.
Yeah, man. You know, it's like So Rafa from Pokies, I think he was working there. Bert Custodio was working there.
Yeah, Bert.
You know what I mean? So there was like all these people trying to get, you know, like, yeah, man, we could do some cool stuff here at Ole Madrid. It's a nice space. But ultimately, I think the owners were just, you know, they put the noose around it. And so they said, all right, man, cool. We'll just step down the street. And then the, you know, Green Circle like blew up for a couple of years, man. That was the spot.
It was the spot. It was the spot. I might have been underage. In a 21 and over bar. Yeah, Green Circle was the spot.
It was, man, I still have to say when I remember seeing The Roots. The Roots were playing there.
Uh-huh.
Early on, man. Like I didn't even really know who The Roots were, but it was with Zeno and Quasar and Peanut, you know, Chris, some of these other cats, and they were just like, yo, man, go see The Roots, man. This band, The Roots, we got to go check them out.
Yeah, yeah.
They're hip-hop, and they play instruments.
Unheard of at the time.
Unheard of.
Yeah, for
sure.
Unheard
of, man. And they had that room with that long stage, and they filled up that whole stage, man. There were so many people up on there playing instruments and, you know, DJ, and, you know, I mean, you just think about it, man. You think about, so you got Questlove, right? So he's on TV every night now.
Right.
And that dude was a youngster in the Green Circle Bar, and we were watching The Roots for the first time, what was probably like their first tour or something back in the early 90s. And Yeah, man, that was like, that was cool, man. That was just, that was cool. And yeah, what I liked about the Roots is, I mean, just, you know, they're very socially and politically conscious. And, you know, and as far as like hip hop, one of the things I really liked about Graffiti, and I was really big, I really loved like Public Enemy and Boogie Down Productions. And then, you know, the Far Side came in, they were just kind of trippy. But then you get, you know, you get Tribe Called Quest and you get the Jungle Brothers. And, you know, you start to get more of that. De La Soul came out with this whole different kind of groove. And, you know, you get Disposable Heroes, and you get just like on and on and on. And you got people like just dropping knowledge, man. WC and the Mad Circle.
Oh, man, those are some good ones.
You know, listen to like some King T, man, the Trifling album, man. I know that everybody, like, they want to talk about Snoop Dogg, dude, but you want some business, dude? The King T, the Trifling album, man.
Yeah.
Dropping it, dude. WC and the Mad Circle, just dropping it. You don't work, you don't eat.
I was going to ask you, I know it's kind of corny, I was going to ask you for your top five, whether it be songs or artists or groups, but you're kind of just doing it right now anyways. I mean, you still listen to hip-hop regularly?
Yeah, yeah, you know what? It's I guess I kind of like a lot more of the older stuff. The newer stuff, I'm hearing kids play, I don't know, man. I'm not as into it, I guess. Being an English teacher, I like, you know, solid lyrics. Like, if you got something to say, then say it. But if you ain't got nothing to say and you're just kind of creating an ambiance or something, man, I ain't got time for you. So say something meaningful, or, you know, I ain't got time for you. So I know that there's people out there doing it. I'm just not around it as much, so I don't hear it. I do still like Psycho Realm. Sick Jack and them, my brother kicks it with him, so, you know, I get to hear more of their stuff. Dead Prez, but, you know, even that stuff's kind of old. I mean, you know, start forgetting, you know, how old I am, right? And so,
yeah.
But then, you know, then again, if we go back to the 90s, there was some cool stuff, like with Oso Motley. So they had cats from the J5 doing stuff with Oso Motley, had Cut Chemist and Charlie Tuna and them, and they're kind of going back and forth. And so, I mean, that, you know, that intersection of stuff that was going on, different types of music, and then of course, you know, like Zach de la Rocha with Rage Against the Machine, basically coming out with hip-hop with, you know, guitars and coming out some pretty socially conscious stuff. So, you know, that's really kind of cool stuff, man. Cool stuff. But if I heard some good stuff today that I liked, then I would be all over it, man. I mean, yeah. I dig it.
No, I'm all over the place with hip-hop, and I stayed stuck in a 90s time capsule for a long time. My students helped me to listen to newer stuff, and but I'm all over the place in the sense that music that some people would call ignorant for justified reasons, I tend to like it, too.
Oh, all right.
I'm a big Too Short fan.
Oh, no. Oh, I was just talking about that with my homeboy last night, man.
And my last interview with Macedonio, we actually exchanged a couple of ideas online because he was just like, why do you like that dude? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, just, I can't stand that dude. And I go, I get it. I know, I understand why, but the man is nonetheless a pioneer.
No, he was, man.
In his time. So I'm just bringing that up because not everything I like is socially conscious or has dope, what people would consider dope, intricate lyrics.
No. I'm totally with that, man. Too Short. I got to give it up to you, man. The Bus 11 with my Walkman.
The Bus 11 bus to Skyline.
The Bus 11, man. Bumping Life Is Too Short, man. You kidding me?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, man. And, you know, and even N.W.A., although I think N.W.A., for what it did, again, was very pioneering. And then when Eazy-E came out with his own solo album, I remember my favorite piece on his solo album was called The Anatomy of a Drive-By.
Mm.
And it was almost more like a poem than a song. And he just kind of described this whole, like, going through the motions of doing a drive-by.
Okay.
And, you know, I think what some people would look at that and go, oh, man, you're just feeding into the violence.
Absolutely.
Another side of it is going to look at it and say, even though what this person is about to go do is a serious act of violence and is probably going to shoot somebody that isn't supposed to get shot, there is this whole human element that moves up to that moment of an individual pulling the trigger. And as a society, especially in a very simple-minded way, when we look at things like mandatory minimums in courts and things like that, funding getting cut off for schools and after-school programs, things where we really just kind of criminalize entire communities, we forget that those are actual individuals who wake up and go to bed every day, and something leads them to the point of pulling a trigger.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a really important thing that hip hop can do. I mean, a lot of people could do it, but I think hip hop has the ability to really humanize this. I don't know. It's almost becomes like a wall. I mean, I know these days the wall is becoming this huge metaphor for just all kinds of stuff, but like this wall, right? There's just like this wall of people, and they're the other.
Mm-hmm.
And hip hop had a real good way of humanizing that other. You know, you listen to like, you go back to listen to Wu-Tang, man. You know what I mean? Ghostface, dude, like, you know, listen to some of that stuff, what they're talking about. And on the one hand, you can be like, dude, you guys are just thugs, or like, you just whatever. And then the other side of it is, these are also people who wake up every morning, and these are people who go to bed every night.
Yep.
And let's not forget that. And somehow something moved them or got them into this situation, or they're portraying a character, right? And so how can we look at, are we portraying a character, or are you just a real reflection of who you are? You know, and it's like with Tupac, and you're not a huge Tupac fan, but you know Tupac, right? If I remember correctly. And you know, the thing that people don't really, you know, people look at Tupac, but they don't really understand that he does come from not a privileged family, but he's related to Assata Shakur.
Mm-hmm.
He's named after Tupac Amaru.
Yeah.
You know, he has this sort of this pedigree of where he comes from. He went to private schools. He studied the arts in private schools, and he was a little kid in Baltimore and things like that. And so, yeah, he came out to the West Coast. He's with family, and he gets involved in all kinds of things. And, you know, we have to ask ourselves, like, how much of that is real and how much of it is also part of the artistry of being Tupac? And I don't know. I mean, he's dead, so we can't ask him that, right? But, you know, there's... It would be an interesting conversation to really kind of look at, because I don't think most people understand that he actually went to school to study art.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's right.
He studied poetry. He studied jazz. He studied, I think, tap dance and all kinds of stuff that is definitely not thug life.
It's not that I'm not a fan. I think I went through a period of probably 4 or 5 years when I just listened to a ton of Tupac over and over and over again. So... I'm a fan of the music. I just don't really bump it anymore.
Oh, I got you. And yeah, I just heard you make a comment on one of your other podcasts.
Did I really?
Yeah, you're saying something about Tupac, and you're like, yeah, I mean, I like it, but I'm not like a huge fan, or it's something. You said something to that effect, and that just like kind of clicked, and I was like, oh man, all right.
I'm much more of a fan of Tupac the man, and his progression as a man.
Yes.
Roses in the Concrete.
Yes.
I'm much more of a fan of that kind of stuff of his. I think, I mean, that showed us the complexities of who he was.
Right.
So I know I am a fan in that aspect.
Okay, I got you.
Just like I'm a fan, I want to know more about folks like you, because you come from where I come from. You got a lot of complexities inside of you that brought you to where you're at.
Oh, yeah.
You're from a graffiti artist to now you're a professor. You're published. I mean, this is poetry. I got a book of poetry right here that you gave me. This is what I'm much more of a fan of than, say, the music that kids really are playing today.
Got you.
Like
got
they, I'm cool with them feeling old school, bumping their Tupac. But please read about him.
Right, right, right.
Right, right. Please understand how he progressed through his life.
Well, you know, and there's a really good video with Maya Angelou when they were, where she talks about when they were working on Poetic Justice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if I remember this correctly, something happened on the set where Tupac got really upset about something. Just got really upset about something. And, Maya Angelou went out and tried to talk to him. And he was just, you know, he was young and he was angry.
Yeah.
And she just like embraced him and was like, I don't remember exactly what she said, but she got him calmed down, and then they started becoming close.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that point, I think if you really look at the timeline, it's at that point when he meets Maya Angelou and she decides she's going to just embrace him for himself and allow him to be the man that he wants to be and help guide him in the direction where he probably wants to go, that's where we start seeing a lot more complexities. And it's really unfortunate that he was killed, because I think if he would have not been killed, that progression would have continued, and the Tupac that we have today would be very different than the Tupac we had 25 years ago.
There's a professor at San Francisco State, shout out to Jeffrey Duncan Andrade,
yeah.
And his program out there called Roses in the Concrete, where, I mean, he uses Tupac a lot. And Sweetwater actually got him to come speak at our latest professional development. I was completely shocked that they would invite Duncan Andrade down. So in his presentation, he talked about that story.
Did he show the video? Because
he showed the video.
So, yeah. So he came to Southwestern College a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
Maybe it was a year and a half ago.
Uh-huh.
And did that, yeah. So
some of our teachers weren't really ready to receive that information, as you might imagine.
I can imagine.
I mean, there's 2,000 teachers. Somebody ain't going to like it.
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
But I was very appreciative that our district would bring somebody with that perspective to talk about how caring for kids is so important, how trying to understand that the stress they go through really affects their emotional growth.
Yeah.
So when you're sitting there looking at a kid who seemingly doesn't care about anything, it's because that stress that brings them up and down each day is really just affecting them greatly. And teachers need to hear that.
No, they do. And, I heard, when I was listening to the podcast with Mase, and you guys were talking about, you had a little back and forth about the restorative justice.
Yeah.
And it's a really good program, but how you implement it and people having the training and people having the patience and people having the buy-in, listening to Mase, he's basically saying that kids get put into his program and other people at those schools are like, they've already given up on these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to have a lot of patience, not just with the students, but he also has to have a lot of patience with the adults around him in order to help make those kinds of programs, Círculo de Hombres and stuff, really, really work.
Mm-hmm.
And, that takes a big toll, man. And I think for some teachers, when they hear somebody like Andrade come and speak and present data, I mean, because he's an academic.
He is.
And he presents data. And he presents research.
Yeah.
And he drops it out. And he's like, dude, you don't have to like it. But, talking to the math teacher, man, do the math. do the math. So, it's kind of hard to argue with it. And people want to argue with it. And it's sort of like, well, if you have to do that much explaining about why you don't want to do something, then maybe your justification for ignoring these things is really corrupt.
Ooh, speak on it. Yeah, that's right.
So, I don't want to, alienate any of your listeners or anybody who could listen. But I think that for the most part, people who sit there and look at the reality of our schools instead of dismantling them with this, I don't know what we're going to call her, DeVos.
Mm-hmm. The devastation of public education.
They're people like that are going to look at what's going on, and instead of sitting there and saying, let's empower teachers, let's empower communities,
mm-hmm.
let's go in, because as far as I know, there's nothing in any union contract, there's nothing in any contract that says teachers cannot work with students and their families to create a new paradigm in a school. As far as I know, there's nothing in any of those contracts that said you can't do that.
No.
And so I think when these private charter schools, corporations come in and people want to start parsing out the money and sending kids here and sending kids there and saying, we're going to give you this new alternative, go to this online school. Apparently, real school or regular school isn't working for you. what we need to do is we need to start empowering the teachers and saying, we're not going to cut your budgets and take your money away from you. We don't want to steal your students away from you, but we want the commitment from you. So let's go in and let's create this new paradigm. Let's go in. And apparently the way school is working for the 2,000 students in your school is working, but for 200 of those students, it's not. So let's find a way that we can work with them without shipping them away and trying to just get rid of a problem. Or they're not going to score high enough on standardized tests, so they're going to look bad. So let's counsel them out. Or let's let them drop out. Or whatever it is. You know? And when I heard, Roberto Rodriguez?
Yeah.
When you had him on, and he was starting to talk about how, you know, the unions need to go out and start becoming more embedded in the communities and doing that kind of thing. I think once we follow that kind of ideology and go out as teachers and really become parts of the community and listen to what they want and look at different ways we can change some paradigms in schools, there's nothing stopping us from having some kind of like special academy at Old Tyre Ranch High School or Sweetwater High School or Eastlake High School or, you know, Montgomery, to say, hey man, here's some kids, and the way the system is set up, this block schedule or whatever is not working for them. Let's go and offer them an alternative and keep them here, and let's see if they can be successful.
Yo, truest shit he ever spoke. One more break and then we head on out. I want you to check out one more video. Just Google Neil deGrasse Tyson GZA, GZA. Okay, and you're going to check out a video with Wu-Tang Clan member the GZA. He gets interviewed by deGrasse Tyson, who is an astrophysicist. He talks about his interest in the universe and how that has played a part in his rhymes. And you should just watch this video to see the look on deGrasse's face as he hears this man's rhymes. Shit is oh so pleasant. All right, we're going to get back into this interview and we're going to take it on out. Peace. So, look, man, I got you here. This is your platform just as much as it is mine. I want to know what's important to you, man.
Important to me. Well, let me do your disclaimer that everything I say is not a reflection of my district or my department or nothing.
I'm going to throw in the disclaimer later, but you know how it goes, bro. Yeah. Whatever we say is on us.
Yeah, that's on us, man. But I think as a representative of education down here in the South Bay and all sorts of things, man. There's so many things. I think we need greater cultural competencies, mm-hmm. with our teachers, and how to get there and how to get there correctly is really going to be difficult, because you have to have the buy-in, and then you also have to have a really good sense of understanding of your students. And one of the things that I didn't really notice as much in the elementary school as I'm starting to see in higher education, the more I'm around working with people around higher education, is that it's really easy to simplify how we categorize students. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody who has an A, an O, or a Z at the end of your name, you're over here. Mm-hmm. And everybody who has a different kind of name is going to go over here, and your complexion is this, so you must be this. And you know, the people when I see at the college a lot is, I mean, we have students here who are fourth, fifth generation Chicanos, Mexican Americans. Some of them are way more American than Mexican, and they're sitting in classes right next to kids who are coming over every day from Tijuana. And for some reason, there are teachers who think, oh, they should be friends.
Right.
And you're like, wait a minute, man. This kid coming from Tijuana is probably like upper class. Mm-hmm. His family's got money. I mean, damn, like, look at his shoes, man. Are you kidding me? This dude's got money. Uh-huh. And, you know, here's this other kid who's, you know, middle of the pack doing his thing. And no, they're not going to talk. And you can't stereotype them. And you can't sit there and go like, oh, you must like this kind of music because you live in this neighborhood. Or you wearing these kind of clothes, so you must be this. Or you know, whatever it might be. And so I think we need to understand our communities a little bit better, doing those sort of like ethnographic studies of who our students really are. Mm-hmm. I think that's really important. And then another thing is just, I'm just really big on critical thinking. And the way I present stuff to students often And correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong, man, because I'm not a math teacher, but I love math and science.
Okay.
I always have.
Okay.
I always love the scientific method, the process of going through and testing, and when it doesn't work, you figure it out and you work through, and you got to have the results, and you got to be able to prove your results. You got to show that they work, and not just if I can do it, it works. If I can do it and three other people can do it, then it really works.
Okay.
You know, and not everything is scalable, because when we start looking at communities, what works in one community doesn't necessarily work in another. And then the other thing, I'll ask my students, you know, some once in a while, and, you know, ask them how many of them like math, you know, and they get like those five hands that go up.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, how come the rest of you don't like math? And they go, well, because it's really hard.
Uh-huh.
Well, okay, but what's really hard about it? Well, if you make one little mistake, then you get the whole problem wrong. And I go, okay, but now let's think about problem solving in general. If you make one little mistake in your problem solving, you're really not solving the problem.
Right.
So you look at problems, social problems, or you're looking at, you know, you're trying to look at something in terms of a piece of literature, a piece of writing that you're going in at. And there's all these different variables. And so, like, I'll write up, you know, I have somebody who likes math. And I'll say, well, give me an equation with multiple variables. And they'll give me these multiple variables. I'll write it up. They'll tell me what to write. And, hopefully I get, you know, somebody who knows some good stuff, or I have somebody come up and write it, and I'll be like, okay, now, you know, really the object of this game, if you look at this equation, it's a puzzle. So it's just like a problem, like a societal problem, a problem that you're looking at in political science or in English. And what we really want to do is we want to find symmetry here. We find symmetry by balancing the equation.
Okay.
Right?
That's right.
Right?
That's right.
So we cannot find symmetry without understanding what all the variables are, how we can put them together, and understanding the relationship that if you change just 1/100th of the value of a variable, that changes its relationship to all the other variables.
That's right.
And so when we start looking at societal problems, if we oversimplify them and we're not looking at the function of X, because X always has a function, right?
Right.
It's not just X. That's oversimplified. When we start looking at big problems, X has a function, Y has a function, and we can break those down, and we have to understand what all those things are in order to really, really address those problems. And when it comes to our schools, it's really easy to look at something and go, oh, well, these kids come from a low socioeconomic area, so of course they're going to have problems. Well, but you're not really understanding what is the function of that X. Let's really get into it. Mm-hmm. What's really behind it? And is what's going on with that student the same as what's happening to the student sitting next to her? And if we're going to look at this school, what works in this school, is that necessarily going to work in 45 or 50 or 150 or 200 schools? Probably not. And when we get things at a higher level, up at the state level and federal level, where people just want to have these sweeping ideas that all of a sudden everybody should be able to do this, we know that that's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
As teachers, we know it's bullshit.
Right, right.
But when we have politicians running the departments of education, when we got billionaires who want to keep making money off of Pearson's and Houghton Mifflin and, you know, who knows what other kind of companies out there, and they're going to make money and get kickbacks and all that shit from those people are making the decisions that trickle down to us that don't necessarily make sense. And the pushback that we have to give can only really happen in our classrooms individually with those students, right?
Right.
But systematically, we're not there making the changes because we're so busy working with those kids that we're not running for office. We're not moving up. We're not going up to Sacramento. We're not at the district offices, the county office of education. We're not trying to get involved with the federal government. We don't have time to go out and start petitions. You know, things like I personally think that any school in the entire United States who's going to take federal funds should be held to the same exact standards as everybody else. So if you have a public school who has to take standardized tests at the end of the year because they're a public school, and you have a charter school who takes money from the government and they have to take those standardized tests, and if these damn vouchers come around and those people are going to start getting money from the government, we'll make them take the fucking test too. And if they ain't going to take the test, take the fucking money away.
That's right.
Because you're taking that money out of the mouths of our students who are coming to our public schools every day. Another thing that goes along with that, that's going on with this repeal of the Affordable Care Act, is that is going to negatively impact our students in special ed. because part of our funds that go into our schools comes from the federal government through the Affordable Care Act, mental health things and stuff like that. That gets axed, then that means you're going to start cutting services to students who really need it.
Mm-hmm.
And we're finally starting to reach a point in our society, I think, well, maybe not our whole society, but at least in San Diego County, where we're beginning to talk about things like mental health issues. We're beginning to look at things like autism and say, okay, so like my son has autism, right? So this is a neurological disorder. And I don't really like the word disorder, but, you know, medically it's what it is.
Okay.
So the way I look at it is we have a lot of individuals who interact with the world very differently than a typical student. So if you have somebody with a very neurotypical being, they are experiencing the world one way.
Mm-hmm.
And then people who have autism, ADHD, PTSD, dyslexia, all these other things, they are interacting with the world very differently. And often they learn coping mechanisms, so they look like they're doing it and they look like they're okay, but they need these additional supports. They start cutting those funds from the ACA, that is going to negatively affect those students. And unfortunately, I think what they're really trying to do, based upon past actions of Republicans, especially conservatives, especially religious conservatives, is they will create more chaos in our schools so that it becomes that self-fulfilling prophecy for them to point the fingers and say, look, they're failing these students.
Absolutely.
Now they can privatize different things. They can bring in somebody who's going to make money off of my kids instead of putting all that money towards my kids. And, you know, and it's not just my son. I speak about an entire community. I mean, South Bay, we're looking, what, 500,000 people or something down here.
Mm-hmm.
They start messing with special ed, everything from GATE down to, you know, severely handicapped students who are just, you know, they have to have student attendance and things like that. We start messing with their lives and how they interact and what they do in schools. And we start messing with those teachers. And, you know, we really, really negatively affect what's going on. Because my son deserves to have just as much of a chance to his abilities as everybody else. And because some asshole motherfucker over in Nebraska wants to cut out the Affordable Care Act to try to look good,
mm-hmm.
and that's going to negatively affect my kid, it's going to negatively affect my neighborhood, it's going to negatively affect my city, my state, and eventually my country, that is not okay.
I care about those kids. I began piloting co-teaching at my site maybe about 6-7 years ago, and I've had special ed students ever since, and I've come to recognize how underserved they already are.
Mm-hmm.
In our district. The requirements that that Common Core put on graduation,
mm-hmm.
really screwed over our special ed students.
Mm-hmm.
My godson is autistic. Mm-hmm. I've had students in my class that performed at a, you know, that performed they were socially capable of capable of what everybody else was. You would never know that they were autistic, but there were little things that I would pick mm-hmm. up on or that I was shown by the special ed teacher, like boom, you know, recognize right. those behaviors. Then I've also had students that, you know, won't say a word in class.
Right.
Everybody knows that they are socially different. They mm-hmm. they absorb information differently.
Right.
But we're very high functioning.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
The beauty of those kinds of students, I mean, you learn so much about people and, yeah. and how we never recognized these people before when we were kids.
No, man. Remember, you never saw special ed, dude. I don't think I remember being maybe in the 10th or 11th grade, and I was in an English or a math class, and I left class in the middle of class to go to the bathroom, and the special ed kids walked by me when I was going to the bathroom. And that's the first time I ever remember seeing kids in special ed and even having an idea that special ed even existed.
Well, that would, you know, that would be like the special day class, right?
Yeah, right.
And so I remember seeing those kids in high school too and understanding what that program was about. But there were still kids. I don't remember, you know, kids being identified as special ed or having an IEP in my classes.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And now I see it. Now I see it and I live it. Yeah, with the mainstream.
Yeah.
And I mean, I had a kid. I had a kid who would never say a word in class, but you could tell him what day you were born.
Yeah.
And he would tell you what day of the week it was.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like, June 22nd, 1973. I wait like 5 seconds and he's like, that was a Friday. I go on to Google and I'm just like, yeah, what? I was like, whoa. You know what I mean?
Dang.
I had a kid that like would perform normally in class, socially, didn't stand out too much. But when I would throw music on in the last 5 minutes, he couldn't help it. He had to get up and dance in front of the class.
Oh, man.
And nobody said nothing. Nobody was tripping, cool, you know. But anywho's, I've come to recognize the complexity and the beauty of special ed students and also just how underserved they already are.
Yeah.
So now you have somebody who's a secretary of education who doesn't understand that the IDEA Act is federally mandated.
That is, and now she's in charge of that federal arm of education, and that is just dangerous.
It blew my mind.
Dude, that...
It blew my mind that she had no idea about that.
That, yeah.
Pun intended.
That, yeah, that's just great. And then even included in with that stuff is... both of my kids are adopted, so we fostered them before we adopted them.
Okay.
And there are a lot of kids in the foster care system that, because they kind of get bounced around and all these sorts of things, they do not necessarily get all of the services that they should. And there's a lot of foster families out there that are very well intentioned, man. I met them. They're great, but they get overwhelmed. They're sometimes dealing with some really, really heavy duty stuff. And the one thing that you can give some of these kids consistently is school. And when we start cutting funds from being able to recognize, or we start cutting the funds for helping students with learning disabilities, or they have mental health issues, or they have PTSD, and those sorts of things, that's also going to really negatively affect our foster care students, because those are some of the highest, those students have some of the highest rates of dropouts, or they're some of the highest drop, have one of the highest dropout rates of all student populations. And that's with what we have. Now, we cut those funds, and we cut our ability to even help those students even more, we're going to make it even worse.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, we just have all these special populations, the kids from that are on the autism spectrum that are able to be mainstreamed. You have kids with certain learning disabilities, and I don't like calling them disabilities either. They're again, it's just a different way that they're able to deal with the world,
right.
And interact with it, and the speed at which they learn and the which they process. And if we cut our ability to help those students, I mean, that's really, really negative. And, you know, when we start looking at the school to prison pipeline, and as of a couple years ago, if I remember correctly, 68% of the males in the California Department of Corrections read at a fourth grade level or lower.
There it is there, right?
And so we already have a situation that's very dire. And with the huge prison population we have in the state of California, and privatized prisons are not helping that situation whatsoever. And if we're going to tie teachers' hands and we're going to cut funding for services that are going to help these students, to have somebody with the intellectual capacity to do third grade work at best is going to have a really, really difficult time in the world. And if those people are ending up in our prisons, and they're in our prisons with some other people who are very smart and very manipulative and very cunning, man, they are creating a personal hell for those individuals. And the best they can try to do is cope. And that often means that they have to do what they need to survive, which does not help them ever get out. And even if they do, they have been gone through some crazy trauma while they're locked up, had to deal with stuff that they don't even understand sometimes what in the world's going on. I saw this in juvenile hall. There were kids who were literally probably like at a 4 or 5 year old mentality, but their parents hadn't gone, or for whatever reason, they had never gotten diagnosed with some kind of mental health issues or anything like that. They had never gotten into special ed, and you got a 15-year-old kid with a 4 or 5-year-old mentality, and he's locked up in this unit because, you know, maybe he did some sort of violent crime. They caught him with a gun, so they throw him in the 1,000 unit, or then, you know, they throw him in the 1,100, 1,200 unit with the violent offenders in the higher, you know, in the higher security areas. And you got people in there who are just, dude, they are criminals.
Predators.
They're predators, yeah. And you put, you know, 4, 5, 6 of them in a room together, and you got one guy who's got the mentality of a 4 or 5-year-old.
Mm.
And that guy, that kid is going to have a really tough time. And it's horrifying. And we do this to people over and over and over. And to tie our hands even further from being able to help these individuals is just, it's pathetic.
Mm. Episode 11, Educated Guest Podcast, Profe Cheno, a.k.a. Michael Wickert. Personal politics. Do you get involved in politics out here, brother?
Not as much as I probably would like to.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Are there any groups or individuals that you follow online, you look for information?
You know, I'm a pretty liberal guy overall. Uh-huh. So, you know, I like to see what's going on much more from the liberal side. I do try to read stuff from a conservative perspective, too, to just kind of see where they're coming from.
Yeah.
It's kind of difficult sometimes because I scratch my head and realize that they're living in a very different world, mm-hmm. from what I understand.
Right.
So it can be a task to get through reading an article sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm not currently involved with any groups. You know, I'm big into the arts and stuff. So I like when I see, you know, things going on with the arts, writers, painters, sculptors. I do like sports, but, you know, sports is kind of a way of bringing different political ideologies together, because right. you can still root for the same team as long as you don't like get too drunk and let the conversation go sideways. You know what I mean? And maybe you come to understand some people a little bit better.
Are you a big baseball guy?
Yeah, I love baseball.
And that's probably the most conservative sport of all.
Yeah.
Ain't nobody taking a knee during the anthem in a baseball game.
No. No, especially in San Diego, man.
I mean, that's about as American as it gets.
Yeah. 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 No, yeah, I love baseball, man. I love baseball.
Which I don't have a problem with. I love baseball too. It was my number one sport growing up. But it's just interesting how politics have seemed to make their way into both the NFL and the NBA, but that shit ain't happening in the MLB, bruh.
Yeah. Well, you know, man, I actually had tickets to go see the Padres play the Rockies on Tuesday, September 11th, and I still got those tickets, and obviously there was no game, but.
Uh-huh.
But then after that, that's when they started doing during the seventh inning stretch, they started playing God Bless America. But, you know, that's not our national anthem.
No.
But people have really sanctified that song as though it is. And that's always been a bit of a thorn in my side. I mean, I go with it. It's become a convention now in baseball. And, I'm not going to kick and scream and tell people to knock it off. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But you're right. I find it interesting how, yeah, definitely in baseball is very, very American. It's a very American thing, even though we have all these players from the Dominican Republic and Panama and Nicaragua and
Cuba
and Cuba and Venezuela.
Canada,
we got people coming from everywhere, but it's still very much an American sport. But, you know, my other one is I really like soccer, so that's much more international, so it kind of balances it out.
Oh, I didn't know you was a soccer guy. I didn't know that. So who do you follow?
Well, you know, I follow the Cholos. I'm really like a hometown kind of guy. Like, okay. I like Cholos. I watch Chelsea and Man U and Bayern Munich, Barcelona. You know, I watch those teams. They're cool, man. It's good soccer. And now my daughter plays. She's U10. I mean, she's U11. She's 10 years old. So I coach her team. So that's cool stuff. I'm learning, man. I'm learning. So like with Andrade, man, he said that. He said, do you have his book? The Art of Critical Pedagogy?
No, I don't have the book. You have the book.
I have the book.
You've read the book.
Yes. And so in there, he has a whole section on coaching and teaching. And so there's like this really cool overlap. So the guy I coach with, Roger, he'll you know, he'll comment once in a while like, "Oh, you put on your teacher voice." You know, and so like there are those kind of overlaps, and it's cool because, you know, I get to work with my daughter and her friends, her teammates. Even though I teach at a college, I get to still work with younger kids. Like today before I came here, I was the person, the pronouncer for the spelling bee for the Chula Vista district.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's cool, man, to be able to still kind of go in and stay connected with the younger kids and the different districts and, you know, be able to do that stuff. Because I think sometimes people will look at you and they go, "Oh, you're a professor." Like somehow that puts you on a different kind of a pedestal.
It does, bro.
But it doesn't.
I know you, but I'm just going to tell you, professor puts you on a whole different level. People try to call me a professor sometimes, and I'm just like, I am not. I'm sorry. I am a math teacher. Because it's different.
But for me, I tell people I'm a teacher, and they go, "Oh, well, you're an English, bro. You teach at a college. You're a professor." I'm like, "Well, yeah, I guess technically, but I'm a teacher first." This is the way I like to look at it.
All right. So this is just one of many conversations that I hope to have with you.
Oh, yeah.
Profe Cheno, a.k.a. Michael Wicker, if you were to describe our session today with one hip-hop song, what are we going to take it out with?
My philosophy.
I think very deeply. All right.
Yeah, my philosophy.
So there we are, episode 11 in the books. Profe Cheno, Michael Wicker, thank you. Thank you for your time and your wisdom.
Wow, that was good, man.
We just scratched the surface today.
Oh, yeah. I think very deeply. Let us begin. What, where, why, or when? We'll all be explained like a structure.